Okay, welcome back to another edition of Sunstone Podcast. I'm your host, John Larson. And, you know, it was, last week was Sunstone. One of the great things about that is you got to meet a lot of interesting people who have a lot of interesting ideas. And I've kind of corralled some of those folks in, and I'm going to have them here on the podcast talking to us. Right out the gate, we have Claire Barris. Claire, thanks for coming into the studio this fine Sunday morning.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, are you a local here in Salt Lake?
Yeah, I'm from Draper.
Draper. I used to live in Draper. It's a fantastic city.
Yeah, I like it there.
Well, so you gave a presentation this time on masonry. We're going to get into some of the connections of masonry and the early church and the Smith family. But first of all, why do you care about this? What is it about masonry that makes it interesting to you?
Well, that's a good question. I like history in general, and I kind of pop around different areas, and I got interested when the Joseph Smith Papers people released the manuscript revelations section. They had a thing on DNC 8 where they talk about the rod. It talks about the gift of Aaron, and then the earlier version of the revelation talks about the rod of nature, and then it's earlier than that, it's the sprout of nature, and I was fascinated by that. So I started studying Oliver Cowdery's rod, which DNC 8 talks about, which you don't know unless you read the earlier versions. Before long, there was a Masonic connection to that, and then I went down the rabbit hole.
So to give the background, the rod that they're talking about is a divining rod.
Yes.
Which most of us have run into. At least stories of people using it to find water. That's a folk magic practice, but it was also used to find other things, and just like crystal balls or seer stones or whatever, it was a way to connect to the mystery.
Absolutely, and it's a fascinating story. Oliver shows up on Joseph Smith's doorstep, and he's got this rod, and he's been using it to receive revelations through. And there's a very fascinating backstory to that, but it ends up in DNC 6 and 8, very subtle references to this rod. But if you know it's there, it makes it more fun reading scripture, which sometimes can be a little dull.
Well, it is. And I think, you know, our ancestors, the individuals who started the church, were much more interesting and complex and compelling people than oftentimes the one-dimensional heroes that we portray them to be. And part of that was just their society. I think it's interesting we talk about things like masonry or folk magic. We tend to think that Mormonism was weird or special or strange because of this. And in a way, it wasn't that strange because these were and are common things. So let's dig into that a little bit. And I oftentimes like to level set and say a lot of these things were much like astrology today. You know, a lot of people read their horoscopes. People discuss it. Some people take it kind of serious. But you could portray it in the future. You know, you could go 500 years in the future and write a paper about people of the early 21st century and their reliance on astrology and that sort of stuff, and make it sound really weird and really strange and dark. But oftentimes, like, folk magic was part of the culture and part of the way we interacted with these things.
Yeah, absolutely, without question. It was fairly normalized. Some people looked down on the folk magic people, but there was a ton of them, and yeah, it was pretty normalized stuff.
So let's kind of have a background, establish why this was there. I think this is really important to understanding American history and Mormon history, that in Europe, you know, the church, be it the Church of England or the Catholic Church, had a long run to establish authority. And they kind of kept the people in check a little bit. They defined what was okay and what wasn't. Now, don't get me wrong, there was all these things that were in Europe too. But when we came out to the Americas and moved to the frontier, of which Joseph Smith and Mormonism was always a frontier religion, they got out in front of the established churches, the parishes and the ordained and trained reverends and folks who sort of interpreted the Bible. What this led is to a big American tradition of starting to read the Bible and interpret it the way that individuals wanted. They had a sudden freedom of religion because they were out away from the clergy. And then you get this folk magic and folk practices that starts to get mixed in, which was probably always much more common with sort of common people as opposed to the elites. And that's where Mormonism was born. So the idea that all of these things got magpied, you know, from Masonry or from folk magic or from wherever it's from, it's not that strange during the period, and it really gave the environment where Mormonism could emerge.
Yeah, and I like the term the burned over district, which is the area, kind of the central nexus where this was. And then the other term is, which talks about time, is the Second Great Awakening, where there's right. this huge religious fervor going on in this environment where there's freedom of religion and there's a mixing of this and of that, and it's kind of like a bubbling cauldron of ideas, of esoteric and religious ideas. And Mormon, yeah, Joseph Smith pops up right in the middle of that.
Yeah, and there's no TV, there's no radio, and so what oftentimes would happen is you would read, you'd go listen to preachers preach, and the itinerant preachers were really it was a form of religious entertainment. You know, you'd go pay your nickel and you'd listen to these guys, and sometimes their shows would be extravagant. And this sort of was vaudevillian too. You'd have people come in and give readings from Shakespeare and all this kind of stuff. But it was what there was to do. So, you know, you'd come in out of the fields and you'd come down to the city center and there'd be a tent there and there'd be some preacher preaching this or somebody doing that. So there was a lot of ideas exchanging hands, and it was a really, kind of exciting time if you were into that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, so let's start with the Smith family and their connection to folk magic. This is something that the church has tried to de-emphasize and basically get rid of by silence, by not addressing it. But we have a lot of evidence of this in their journals, in their own writings, and they didn't consider it to be something shameful. So the early saints just talked openly about this stuff.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we have, there's a lot of really overwhelming evidence. You have the a set of affidavits that were collected by Ebert E. Hall and Philastus Hurlbut that were published in 1834 that detail the Smiths' neighbors and relatives talking very frankly and openly about their magical practices. You have a court document of 1826 that talks about Joseph Smith, the glass looker, who's on trial for doing this stuff. And you've got Lucy Mack Smith in her manuscript history referencing the faculty of Abrac and magic circles that her family was involved with. And it goes on and on and on. Well, not on and on and on, but there's enough evidence that you cannot question it. It's definitely there.
Yeah, and so they might have, I don't know the best words to use, different... astrological or kind of almost like spells. And I hate even using those words because it's so impregnated with all the meaning Disney's given it. You know, these things that might be written with symbols that are charms or amulets and these things that it's really not much different than people walk around today and they might have their lucky stone on their string. But we have these artifacts. We have the seer stones. We have the ceremonial daggers. We have some of these things. They're scattered about. We have photos. They exist.
Yeah. The layman's or the magic parchments. We have three of those. The magic dagger that has an occult symbol on it. We're in possession of Eldred G. Smith, who was the church patriarch, recently handed over to the church. And without question, we have pretty interesting stuff. And maybe later, I, if we get time, we can dive into how some of these things were used to control spirits and how they draw magic circles to contain the spirits or try to keep them out. And it goes on and on, and it's pretty fascinating stuff.
So, indeed. And one of the big differences is with religion, you use an intermediary to ask God to do things. You know, you might pray for rain or, as you know, in our tradition, it's always moisture. You might pray for moisture. The difference between religion and magic has manipulation of symbols just like religion does, but it's a direct action. That in magical beliefs, if you do these things, then you can make it rain directly, to use the kind of a trite example.
Right, exactly.
But they're about accomplishing kind of the same thing. Now, one thing that I think is important that we need to talk about is Joseph Smith, especially when he moved to Palmyra, was right square in the heart of Iroquois country that had been pushed from this land, who had been there a long time. And the reason I bring this up is the Iroquois were a very strong and powerful tribe, and they had a lot of wealth, and they had burial practices. They would bury their dead not too deep, but they didn't leave them up on like stands like some of the Plains Indians did. But they would also bury them with their war implements. Now Western Europeans had been in America since, you know, the early 1500s, and they started trading with these guys, and one of the things that they traded for was swords and breastplates. And, you know, because if you think about, like, the 16th century, these guys are still walking around with spears and swords and all that kind of stuff. So we fast forward to the 19th century, and there were people who were treasure diggers. But one of the reasons treasure digging became such a big thing in that area is there was actually treasure in the ground. You could dig up these Indian burial sites and find swords and find breastplates and stuff. Most of these would have come from the Spaniards, but they might have been buried in the ground for 200 years before these folks found them. So when we have this big tradition of treasure digging, I just want to establish that it wasn't without some merit, these activities, and they did find things because the Iroquois would bury their dead with these war implements.
Yeah, that's right. And there's these burial mounds all over the place, and absolutely.
And including, you know, the drumlins, these little mounds, of which Hill Cumorah was one, which are a geological remnant of the great big glaciers that came down.
Yep, yep.
And the reason that's important is these were mostly loose rock, loose dirt, because it was pushed there. So there were burial sites all over in these hills from the Iroquois. So this is where kind of everything starts. And you mentioned that the 1826 arrest of Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith was a well-known treasure digger. He was a finder of things, and he would use folk magic to do that. For example, the seer stone, which of course he later used to translate the Book of Mormon.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's some interesting evidence. Like I said, one of many things that established that he was definitely a treasure seeker. And as you pointed out, the church has been kind of reluctant to point that out, but I don't think they should be. I think it's a matter of trying to understand the context and see Joseph Smith as someone who evolves from a treasure seeker to a prophet. And I don't see any problem with that. In fact, I think it's pretty cool.
Okay, I do too. I think it's interesting. I think it's part of who he was, and it's a shame we try to cover it up. Okay, so one of the papers that you've written establishes a connection between the magic and the masonry. Now, the general common narrative is that Joseph Smith didn't really encounter or didn't really engage masonry, although Cowdery was a Mason. And Joseph Smith's father had joined Masonry earlier, but Joseph Smith doesn't really start incorporating Masonic elements until Nauvoo. But there's some folks who argue that actually occurred earlier in Kirtland. So let's kind of now triangulate the connection between Joseph Smith, Masonry, and this magical stuff. So maybe let's give a little background on Masonry.
See, you have Masonry goes way back into the Middle Ages. And it kind of is percolating ideas, and you have these guilds of stone of masons that build things, and they kind of have their fraternities, and as time goes on, an element gets introduced into masonry called speculative masonry, which is kind of a more doctrinal and mythological elements that get pulled in. Mostly from the Old Testament, and when I say mythological or myth, it's kind of religious ideas or legendary ideas, and it's not when I say myth, it's not like it's false. It's more like they're legends and beliefs. But this speculative masonry percolates into these Masonic guilds, and then in 1717, you have the formation of the first of the Grand Lodge in London, and they organize Masonry, and that's kind of the formal beginnings of Freemasonry.
That's where they come out of the closet, so to speak.
Yes,
and like you're saying, these guilds, they would have been very common. I mean, if we're like in the 12th century in Europe, you don't have any papers, like, and most people can't read anyway. So if you're moving from town to town, and especially like these the Masons, the stonemasons, they spent most of their time building cathedrals and castles. And so you would start building a castle or a cathedral, and suddenly you needed 150 stonemasons. But any Yahoo could wander into town and say, I'm a stonemason. So what they had is you'd be a part of a guild, and you'd need to prove you were part of the guild. So the guilds tended to have these secret rites of handshakes or passwords or whatever. And that was a common practice so that we could establish that you were actually a journeyman, stonemason, and you could do that quality of work, and you were entitled to that level of pay. Now, because the Masons were building churches and castles, they oftentimes got caught up in this sort of religious rite. Everything about cathedrals, the way they're shaped, the way they're built, it all has like meaning, or it was impregnated with meaning. And so it became a natural outlay that these sort of mystic elements from the cathedrals crept into their practice. And it disappears in time. We don't know how old Freemasonry was, but we do know in the 18th century they came out and they started freely acknowledging that these secret orders existed.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And then you have this, as Masonry is formalized in London and in Europe, you have people coming over to America that are Masons, and they want to establish Masonry in America. And so you have different degrees popping up here and there, but it's very disorganized in America. And eventually, people in America say, hey, we need to kind of organize this stuff. And so you have, let me overview briefly the three basic elements of the York Rite. There's craft masonry, which kind of stories about this dude named Hiram Abiff and building Solomon's Temple. Then there's Royal Arch Masonry, which are stories of building Solomon's Temple, and then after the temple is destroyed. And then there's cryptic rite masonry, which is about an underground temple that Enoch builds. And then there's Knights Templar masonry, which is kind of about Apostle Paul and the Crusades. But these three masonries plus the foundational craft masonry make up what's called the York Rite. And are the foundation of this. And so in America, like I said, the York Rite kind of is premier over the Scottish Rite. And Royal Arch Masonry gets organized in 1798 in America by a guy named Thomas Smith Webb. And then Cryptic Rite Masonry gets organized in 1818 by a guy named Jeremy Cross. And that's kind of the foundation of the York Rite. And that kind of gives you kind of an overview. So as we talk about these, you can hopefully people can fit this into which collection of degrees these are.
Yes, and by the time they get to America, these have nothing to do with stonemasonry anymore. Of course, it's a fraternal rite. It's a way to create business connections, to get introduced to the movers and shakers, to find out who it is that you need to be in alliance with. It's a way of taking a complicated world and making it less complicated.
Yeah.
So, because of that, you know, when two guys get together and they make a business deal, the guy who's not involved in that business deal feels like he's been cheated. So there's this constant push and pull around masonry, where on the one hand it's a fraternal brotherhood, but if you're outside of it, then you feel like there's a conspiratorial element keeping you from being successful.
Exactly.
So it's this strange thing where people and of course they're still at the time they're still sworn to secrecy, you know, and they take that very seriously, of course. And masonry has blood punishment for breaking the secret of masonry for saying you're in. So it does have this cloud of kind of suspicion. And people who don't think it's a very good thing.
Yeah, and later this will really play out in 1826 during what's called the Morgan Affair, and the paranoia sweeps the country, and the country basically becomes very anti-Masonic. And in response to a lot of the secrecy stuff that's going on.
Which coincides with the time that Joseph is arrested.
Exactly, yeah. Same year. Yeah, it's right at the same time. So
and when we say arrested, this wouldn't be like getting arrested for, I don't know, distributing heroin. This is kind of like a public nuisance sort of arrest. It is a big deal in one way, because there's a story the church is telling about this boy who's walking around who won't drink alcohol and is communing with God. And on the other hand, the magistrates are clearly annoyed with him. They think he's fleecing people for money.
Yeah, juggling. They call it juggling, which probably meant something a little differently back then.
Do you have any idea what they meant by that?
I don't. I can't remember. I read it and it's escaped me.
Yeah. So Joseph would use rods or stones or whatever to find treasure, and there were these folk beliefs around these spirits who would guard treasure, which is something that shows up like genies. A djinn is the same sort of thing in an Eastern tradition. It's a spirit that guards treasure. Yeah. And these things had power to, like, move treasure around, which shows up right in the Book of Mormon. You know, it says at the end of the book, they would bury their treasure, and then it would move.
Their slippery treasure, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a folk belief, which, of course, would explain why the treasure seeker who found some kind of, I don't know, had some spirit telling them it was there, and they dig, there wouldn't be anything there. Then they had a story. Well, the spirits, we didn't draw the circle around the tree and hallow the moon three times correctly, so the spirit was moved.
Right, right, right. Yeah, yeah. Joseph, there's a very fascinating story of Joseph, and he's sitting in the house looking at a seer stone in the hat, watching the spirit. And Joseph Smith Sr. is out, and Joseph Smith Sr. draws a magic circle, and then he puts a bunch of rods in the ground, and then a central set of rods, and they're digging, and they can't find anything, and Joseph is watching, you know, the spirit, and anyway, the treasure slides through the earth is what the spirits make it slide through the earth, and they are not able to obtain it. So it's a fascinating picture of what's going on.
Now, what else is interesting in all this is folk magic and masonry. Well, let's start with masonry. Masonry would pull, as you implied, would pull a lot of its stories and imagery and things from the Bible. Like Hiram, yeah. Abiff, there is a mention of Hiram as one of the architects of the temple or whatever. It just in one passage in the temple, in the Bible, it just mentions the dude. Yeah. And then, of course, this narrative is built up around it. And masonry would pull from Egyptian belief and Christian and Hebrew and all sorts of things. So right. It's built on that mythology.
Yes. Yeah. It's all biblical based, but expansions of biblical stories. Yeah. And it's fascinating to trace it from the beginning down. Yeah. Down through. It's a fascinating history.
Which when people were engaging it, they'd see this connection. They'd say, oh, I've read this stuff in the Bible, yep. And now I'm seeing this stuff in masonry. That must mean that it's true. It's the Mormon couplet, you know, if it's established by more than one witness. So for early Mormons, they would see masonry, and they'd see confirmation or parallels to what they were doing, and they would see that as a confirmation that masonry itself was also true.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think this resonated with Joseph Smith at a very young age when he heard these stories. And I think it shifted him from a treasure seeker into somebody who was seeking for buried scripture. There's some fascinating stories in the Cryptic Rite and Royal Arch Masonry that are very similar to Joseph Smith's story of the recovery of the Book of Mormon in translation.
So one of your arguments is that you can trace kind of the shift from this folk magic treasure seeking to an engagement with masonry through Smith.
That's my theory. I think there's a set of parallels, and if we get time, we could talk about them. And I think I think that it's quite compelling.
Well, yeah, let's dig into it a little bit. So kind of outline how you see that transition happening.
Okay. Well. So, all right, I want to try to tell the Masonic story and then hit the parallels with masonry. So in the beginning, according to masonry, and there's Masonic books, and then there's the rituals and mythology, and God is the first Mason, and he architects the universe and the earth, and he creates the earth, and he puts Adam in the garden, And then he tells Adam what's called by Masons the Word, or the ineffable Word, or it's the secret name of God, is to be kept secret and passed down through the generations by Masons and kept sacred and secret by Masons. And so this is a huge concept in Masonry, along with temple building. These are the two big concepts in Masonry. So Adam gets the word, and then he passes it on down. Enoch ends up as the holder of the word, and he's the guy with that. And then this is where the cryptic Masonry comes into play that we talked about earlier. In their mythology, we learned that Enoch, he lives in a time where there's all this wickedness, and the earth is about to be destroyed with the flood, and he has a vision that he's supposed to build a temple. And so he builds an underground temple in Mount Moriah, which is where Solomon's temple is later built, and you know it's the Temple Mount, but it's Mount Moriah. And he builds 9 chambers, and in the last chamber, he puts a golden plate. He creates a golden plate, and he inscribes the name of God on that. Puts a stone lid on this chamber, and then he's told to visit the place once a year. He goes once a year to visit this mount that has the underground temple in it. He also builds a pillar of brass and a pillar of marble, and these are huge pillars. And he inscribes in the pillar of brass the story of creation, arts and sciences, all the doctrines of Freemasonry, and in the pillar of marble, he inscribes a message that says that there is a valuable treasure buried in this hill below that contains the essence and end of Freemasonry. And so this is the story from cryptic rite Masonry. Now, there's some great parallels, I think.
For sure, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about those. Of course, you have wickedness and destruction about to occur, and prophet building, you know, trying to record a record of everything. Think about Mormon and Moroni in the Book of Mormon. Everybody's getting wiped out. They're trying to get the gold plates put together to bury in a hill so that it can be recovered at future time. Same thing with Enoch in the cryptic rite. The idea of Enoch having a vision to build the temple. Joseph Smith has a revelation to build a temple. And interestingly, if you think about who were temple builders in America, you've got the Mormons, you have the Masons, which all of their rites are surrounded. A Masonic lodge is the interior of a temple. And then you have one other very obscure group, which Oliver Cowdery's father was a member of, called the New Israelites. And I'm not aware of any other temple-building group in early America at all. So I think that's a kind of an interesting parallel. You also have the gold plate of Enoch, and of course in the Book of Mormon you have the gold plates. You have Enoch's record of brass, and you have the plates of brass in the Book of Mormon. They both contain the doctrines of the people and the story of creation. In fact, in the Book of Mormon, it's so important that they get their record of brass that they go back and they chop off Laban's head and go through all that fun stuff, you know. So there's that. The pillar of marble, think about this. It has written on it that in this hill there's an extremely valuable treasure buried below that contains all the truths of Masonry. Think about when Joseph Smith hears about that, I think in the 1820s, and he's like, holy crap. This is my speculation. Why am I digging for golden candlesticks and furniture? I should be looking for buried scripture instead. And that's exactly what this story tells. And I think that probably triggered Joseph Smith to shift what he was looking for. And he transitions from a treasure seeker to a scripture seeker, basically.
It's probably happened to everyone. You're sitting in Sunday school and suddenly you think, wait a minute, I've heard this all before, about 100 times. I'm ready for something new. Well, I'm happy to report that your dream Sunday school class is just a click away at the Sunstone Magazine podcast. Here, you get to hear the best Sunstone articles in an Audible quality package. You'll hear about everything, from the First Vision to feminism, from LGBT issues to scriptural interpretation, from polygamy to poetry, from scholarship to mysticism, from personal essay to fiction. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. Come join the Sunday school class you wish you had.
Yeah, and there's other folk beliefs at the time that influenced this. For example, it wasn't that uncommon of a belief that the American Indians were descended from Jews. That idea was floating around in the ether at the time. And so, it sparked my imagination when you're talking about that Masonic idea of the corruption of these pure forms. That's a theme that comes up in Masonry over and over again. That there was in the golden past, there was this scripture or this priesthood or whatever that was pristine, and then it became corrupted, and we're trying to restore that. We're trying to come back to it. We're trying to rebuild the temple.
Yes.
The things were, which of course is the foundational theme of Mormonism, right? Yes. That the gospel, the true word of God, needed to be restored. It needed to be returned to an ancient order. So both of those ideas, of course, merged into Mormonism as he's looking around. Now, I also saw the parallel you didn't bring up that Joseph described when he returned the plates, especially, you know, that he pulled them out of a stone box that Moroni sent him to. But when he returned the plates, the hill opened up and he went into a big room.
Oh, yes.
That was full of treasures.
Good point.
And of course, you know, the other parallel is Joseph Smith, from the beginning, claimed not just that he got out the golden plates, you know, that have this hidden truth, but there was a sword there and there was a breastplate there. And those two things are very significant. The sword is kind of easy to deal with. Swords and knives are very routinely used. They're used to transcribe, to cut or to write in dust. And they're also used to protect. Now, in Masonry, there's the concept of a tire, and the tire is the individual who sits at the door and keeps anybody from coming. And they would have a ceremonial sword. So I've often wondered that parallel between the sword of Laban, which of course shows up in the narrative later, but he was talking about it before he wrote the book. So, which would be a protection device, and of course the breastplate would be a sign of authority and a means of translation.
Yeah, I think it was John Taylor that was the tiler at the Masonic Lodge in Nauvoo, and he would be armed, have a sword, and he would guard the entrance, which is an interesting image.
Well, it is, and when the individual snuck into the temple in the early 20th century to take pictures when they were doing a renovation,
right.
One of those photos shows the entrance to the first chamber you go into during the temple ceremony, and there was a seat for the tire, and there was the sword right there. So in early, even LDS temple rites, that they used to use a sword as part of the ceremony.
Yeah, and I think that too is I suspect it might be the angel that stands guard to prevent Adam and Eve from entering back into the garden, the cherubim.
Yes.
It stands with a flaming sword guarding the way of the garden.
Correct. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. And that's imagery that Joseph Smith brings again and again. You know, when he's trying to justify polygamy, it was the same thing. You know, this thug of the Lord who has a sword, and if you don't follow along or you're not worthy, you can't cross.
Yeah. Well, another interesting thing I found is that you have, Enoch was allowed to visit the Temple Mount, the buried temple, once a year. Joseph Smith is required to visit the hill Cumorah once a year by the angel. And then you have, Enoch, Joseph Smith. Do you remember, old-timers remember when the DNC had all these funky names, you know, like Pellagorum and Shinehaw, instead of Kirtland and Sidney Rigdon? Well, and they were code names to kind of obscure who they were talking about because they had creditors trying to get to them. But Joseph Smith's name is Enoch. And so I find it interesting that you have this Enoch character here who's very, you know, kind of fulfilling a Moroni Mormon role. And then you have Joseph Smith, who names himself, who's named Enoch through this revelatory way. I find that kind of curious. One other thing, too. So you have the writings of Enoch in cryptic rite masonry. They're on these pillars. Well, Joseph Smith, after the organization of church, remember, he restores the writings of Enoch in the Book of Moses in the Pearl of Great Price. He recovers those through revelation.
Right, right.
Yeah. So, okay, so that's cryptic rite masonry. That's the time of Enoch. Okay, then in Masonic mythology, we fast forward to the time of of Solomon's Temple. And this story is told in craft masonry, the first three foundational degrees. And we've talked about this guy already, Hiram Abiff, who's only mentioned once in the Old Testament, as you pointed out. But he, in Masonic lore, he is the keeper of the word. He's the one dude that knows the secret word.
And as you're going through the ceremony, you are ceremonially representing him.
Yes.
You become Hiram Abiff as you go through this rite.
Right, right. And so, yeah, so initiates, and he's the guy that's in charge of building Solomon's Temple. And anyway, these ruffians track him down, and they want the word from him, and they threaten his life. He won't give up the word, so they kill him, and he dies. And then the word is lost, and it's a huge crisis at the time. It's like, oh my gosh, we've lost the secret name of God, and it's terrible. So Solomon creates a substitute word that is used by Masons for the time being, but there's the word will come back coming down here. So in Mormonism, when I say Mormonism, I know that that's a charged word, but you know I don't like saying Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saintism.
Well, we need to make an important point here. The Brighamite Church, who says they don't want to be called Mormons anymore, they don't control these stories. These stories are adopted by literally hundreds and hundreds of different sects that come off from Joseph Smith.
Exactly.
So it's the pinnacle of arrogance to suggest that they can take the stuff that's a communal activity and say it's not Mormon.
Right.
So go ahead and say yeah, Mormon.
Mormon is the overall blanket of all of Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith is Mormonism. Yeah. So so in Mormonism, so this is where we get temple endowment parallels is from craft masonry and the Hiram Abiff story. So basically, when Joseph Smith Joseph becomes a Mason, and then literally like a week later, just shortly after that, he restores the temple endowment, which they believe to be a restoration of ancient corrupt masonry, that they restore it to its pure original form. And that's what the endowment was to Mormons back at that time.
Right, and I think it's worth noting that to me, when I read Smith, this is one of many inputs he had. He was very influenced by Masonry, especially the Nauvoo period. But Young, he loved Masonry. Like, and you know, he wore you know the G, geometry G with yep. the square and compass and this symbology. So the 1877 endowment, the one that was really driven by Young, that had Adam God in it. It was very much an embracement of Masonry.
Yeah. Absolutely, and Brigham ran with that. He Joseph started it, and then Brigham took it and ran with it, and added some of his own flavor to
right.
it.
Right, and Young said, and others talked about just like there was a falling away and there was a restoration. That was part of Masonry too. Masonry had elements of the original gospel and the original priesthood authority that had fallen away. So it just fit into this restoration narrative to restore from Masonry what was true and to restore from Protestant Christianity what was true.
Yeah, and so as I read about the word and Masonry, I like to try this exercise in your mind. Substitute priesthood for the word, that something that's passed down through the patriarchs, you know. And then Masonry is kind of like the gospel. It's like, you know, the gospel. I think there's it's at least fun to ponder on that idea.
I like that parallel, yeah.
So you've got the endowment, which is really a restoration of craft masonry. They lose the word. Hiram Abiff is killed, and they lose the word. There's a substitute word that's given by Solomon. That word is referenced in the temple. And I won't go into details, but it's when people are going through the final veil and they repeat back some stuff. And there's a reference to the substitute word that is used in masonry.
And let's take a brief minute to kind of talk about what happens there in the temple as you go through these rites, and you get this hand signal that has a name. This is straight from masonry, and then it basically has a kind of a secret name, and it has a punishment associated with revealing the name or the sign or the token. So as a sign, as a token, as a name, and those ones that you do in the temple, you do four of them, if I remember correctly, they are all taken straight from this rite of masonry. And, yep. And as a matter of fact, I went to the temple in 91. I missed the old 1990 ceremony by like 8 months. But for me, I was confused after I went to the temple, and I got a book of Duncan's Ritual and read it. And to me, then the temple made sense because it filled in all the cracks of what they weren't talking about.
Yep.
So I bring this up because what a lot of Mormons are practicing a part of a Masonic ceremony, but not the full thing. So they don't have some context for what they're doing, which is especially true after 91, after doing these hand signs. The temple doesn't tell you what the hand signs are. But if you go back and read Masonic stuff, and I'll leave that as a homework assignment, it'll tell you exactly what they are, and they're a little gruesome. I'll give you that.
Well, yeah, and I did go to the pre-91 temple, and there were right out of masonry there were penalties, it's kind of a little shocking to think what you know these your grandparents were doing in the temple, reenacting ritualistic methods of murder for revealing the secrets of the temple.
But to circle back to what you're saying, these things had secret holy names, and those names had power. So you were being revealed these elements that weren't just a religious rite like sacrament or baptism or last rites. These things, from a Masonic perspective, were imbued with some sort of magical power. To have a new name, to have
yes,
these things.
Yes, absolutely. It's very esoteric and full of power. Well, it's an endowment of power that occurs to us. And like I said, it was considered to be a restoration of ancient masonry, a true restoration of the original.
Which was in itself a restoration of the original Solomon temple rites.
Yes, exactly. So here's one of the things that, if you know about what's going on in masonry, it makes more sense in Mormonism. Again, this has been done away with, though. So there used to be a thing called the Five Points of Fellowship.
Yes.
And it was kind of a ritual embrace where this important word was shared, the Masonic word. But in Mormonism, it's more than a word. But it was done on this kind of a ritualistic embrace. And in the Hiram Abiff story, Hiram is, remember, he's killed, he's buried in some rubble. When Masons find his body, they lift him up, they raise him. And this is what Masons happen to them. They get raised, like Hiram Abiff. From the dead, Hiram is raised up on the Five Points of Fellowship. So they just did away with the Five Points of Fellowship, but a lot of people remember them. But that illustrates what's going on. This is a resurrection motif that's going on here that I think that helps understand the endowment better if you understand what's going on in masonry.
It is, and then let's be clear where this occurred in the temple. The Five Points of Fellowship happened when you greeted God through the veil, when God was bringing you through the veil, kind of a soul resurrection into the celestial kingdom. So we have pieces of it left. If you remember, when you approach the veil there, you have the slits in the veil where you put your hand through and God puts his hand through. And in the old days, that used to be in the Five Points of Fellowship. And then they kind of kept doing it, but they quit defining it. That's why one of the reasons the temple is vague is over the years, they just kept pulling out exposition, but leaving the ceremony in sort of intact. Because in the old days with the Five Points of Fellowship, you didn't just make contact with hands on shoulders. You touched hip or something else down there. I can't remember.
Yeah, yeah. And so, right, right. It, yeah, there's you're reading, like you said, Duncan's Ritual, which is available in a lot of bookstores, is the Masonic rites. And it's a fascinating read, and I think can help people understand.
Every endowed Mormon should go through it, and it's not there's nothing about it that, well, it might question your faith, but it doesn't have to. There's plenty of people who know Duncan's Ritual thorough backwards and forwards and still enjoy the Mormon Temple Sermon.
Without question, yeah, yeah. And it's for people who want to. There are different types of people in the church. Some people want to know everything and look under every rock and understand it deeply and fully, and others prefer to have more of a correlated view, and that's fine too. And for people who like to know the whole story, I would suggest that's something to read.
So this might be a good time for us to talk about the Urim and Thummim and the breastplate.
Well, yeah, and so that's... And that actually comes up in Royal Arch Masonry. So, yeah, let's dive into. So we're at the time of Solomon. We fast forward now. The temple has been destroyed, and these Masons want to help rebuild it. They're sorting through the rubble, and they find this stone lid in the ground. They open it up. They rappel down in. Now. Those of you who are Indiana Jones fans, this ought to sound familiar, okay? And there's a reason, because they're based on the same story. They rappel down into this thing, and down in there is the Ark of the Covenant. And so they bring it up, and they present it, and they bring it to what's called the Grand Council. The Grand Council, which is a prophet who's a scribe, a priest, and a king. And this Grand Council is like, holy crap, this is cool stuff, the Ark of the Covenant. They open it up, and inside of the Ark, they find a lost book of Scripture, the book of the law of the Lord. They find a key, it's called, that's used for translation. There's hieroglyphs on the Ark of the Covenant, and there's other sacred items in this in the Ark. So the high priest of the Grand Council, he basically puts on a breastplate, and he takes this translating key, and he translates the hieroglyphs, and lo and behold, it's the lost word.
Now, and before we get there, yeah. there's a breastplate described in the Old Testament that represents the 12 tribes that the high priest would wear. Yes. Is this the same?
Yes.
The same thing?
Yeah, absolutely. It's based on Aaron's ceremonial garb. You know, there's all this stuff, but it's a breastplate, and in the breastplate, that's where the Urim and Thummim are stored with Aaron. And so now you have this breastplate that the Masonic high priest is wearing, and what is he doing? He's translating, which is interesting. Now, Joseph Smith, remember, he has the Urim and Thummim. A fascinating story in Lucy Mack Smith's family memoir. Lucy talks about when she first sees the Urim and Thummim, and she says, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm pretty close here, but not exact, but she's like Joseph says, "Mother, look what I have found. Look what I have. I have found a key." Mm. He calls it a key. And then she says, I took the device in my hand and I looked at it. And then she describes it. It was two triangular pieces of glass in a silver bow. You know, she's describing this translation device that Joseph Smith has recovered, but it's called a key. Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly what it's called in the Masonic, in the Royal Arch Masonry. The high priest uses a key to translate the characters wearing a breastplate. Now we have Joseph Smith wearing a breastplate using his key, the Urim and Thummim, to translate these characters.
Correct.
Yeah. So, all right. So, the Mormon. So that's one of the parallels with Mormonism. We've got the gold. Remember, this is taken out of. So this crypt that they go down into. This is one of the nine chambers of Enoch's buried underground temple, and that's where they get the Ark of the Covenant. That, remember, lower is the gold plates are buried down there. You have the Grand Council, which is an interesting name in Mormonism. Remember, in the pre-existence, it's the Grand Council, right, that's running the show up there. So that terminology is used. The Grand Council is made up of a prophet, priest, and king. That becomes very important to Joseph Smith theology, particularly in the Nauvoo era, this prophet, priest, and king.
Nauvoo into Salt Lake. So we have the transition of governance to Joseph being the prophet, priest, and king, of which both John Taylor and Brigham Young took that mantle, and then the Council of 50, who was the governing body underneath that.
Exactly, exactly, yes.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Hanson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these Firesides, featuring a weekly evening podcast. It will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
And then you have this book of the law of the Lord that is in the ark, and it's this lost scripture that Moses had told people, put it in the ark. Now it's recovered, and it contains new truths that were written by Moses that are restored. It's a restoration of scripture, which is this recurring theme that we keep seeing occurring here. Interestingly, in Nauvoo, Joseph Smith calls his journal the Book of the Law of the Lord, the same name as this Masonic Book of Moses. And Joseph Smith, what does he translate after the Book of Mormon? The Book of Moses. We have a restoration of the Book of Moses. So I find that all quite interesting.
Fascinating indeed. Yeah, the parallels are definitely there. And you know, one of the questions is how involved he was with Masonry. But have you ever been a Mason?
No.
Neither have I. So I just point that out because we're both talking here about Masonry, and neither of us have ever joined.
Exactly.
Joseph was a smart kid. He went to the library. He talked to people that I don't know necessarily the source, but there's those around him, Oliver and his father in particular, who were more sourced in this. But we don't have Joseph actually joining a lodge until Nauvoo.
Right. Joseph's brother Hiram is a Mason. And Joseph Smith Sr. may have been a Mason. There's evidence that suggests he might have been. Joseph Smith's neighbor, the Chases, Durfee Chase, who was very close with the Smiths, was a Royal Arch Mason and the head of the Masonic chapter there for a few years. And so, and there's a ton of Masonic stuff being talked about all over the place.
Well, and the Chases, to remind everyone, it was Sally. Her name was Sally.
Yeah,
Sally Chase. Joseph Smith. One of his first conflicts after when he first started the church. You know, the idea was revelation was available to everybody, but there was some. Joseph Smith got his seer stone, helping the Chases dig a well. And there was some back and forth about whether Sally Chase could do prophecy or he did. But it's one of those early like battles between about authority and these magical items were involved with the Chases.
Yeah, you're right. It's the Chase stories are fascinating. Willard Chase was probably doing treasure seeking with Joseph Smith. Sally has got the green stone that Joseph Smith uses to find his seer stone. Durfee Chase helps the Smiths out when they're in a time of need in 1825. Turns out he's a Royal Arch Mason and the head of the, and earlier ahead of, he was in charge of the Masonic chapter there in town. And so you got a lot of, I think, influence going on there. Not only that, but, and this is a whole nother episode, is Oliver Cowdery comes from a family of Masons. And the story of their involvement in Masonry is it's fascinating. Yeah. Now, so we were talking about the plate, right?
Yes.
And you have this plate, the breastplate. There's some interesting magic parallels with that. We can talk about
it. Yeah, sure. Let's go in. That's okay. Fun stuff.
All right. So Joseph Smith had these. We talked briefly about the magic parchments that Joseph Smith had. He had three magic parchments, and these parchments are called laymans. And the word layman actually means plate. That if you translate it from Latin, it's plate. And they were used for protection. They were used in ceremonial magic for protection, to purify, and to control spirits. That was a big part of it. Probably used in treasure seeking. One of the parchments is called the Holiness to the Lord parchment. And there's one symbol in there that that says, basically, it means that whosoever beareth this sign, all spirits will do him homage. And then there's another symbol that means whosoever beareth this sign need fear no foe. Mm. So you got this magic potency. The Holiness to the Lord parchment is gold. We only have black and white photos, but we know from descriptions of it that it had a gold backing on it. Why? Because it represents the gold plate that Aaron, we talked earlier about Aaron's ceremonial breastplate.
Right.
He also had a ceremonial headpiece that was made out of a gold layman or a gold plate. And on that was inscribed the word Holiness to the Lord. And he would wear that on his forehead. Well, magicians would also do that. Magicians in ceremonial magic would sometimes place a layman or the representation of a gold plate on their forehead, like Aaron, and do their magic business. We also talked about Aaron's breastplate. Well, some magicians also, instead of wearing a layman on their forehead, they would wear it on their chest like a breastplate, like Aaron's breastplate. And of course, that's where the Urim and Thummim is tied in, is this breastplate that's on the chest. And I think that it's possible that Joseph Smith's breastplate that we hear about in Masonry was actually his layman that he had, which is basically a representation of a breastplate. The layman would be folded in half and in half again and put in a little 4x4-inch pouch. The length of the strap suggests that Joseph Smith would wear that over his neck and it would hang right over his chest like a breastplate. And this is what magicians would do. They would do this.
I'm not real well schooled in this, but I've seen artwork, even artwork out of the Middle Ages. It would oftentimes show the priests of Aaron wearing this thing. I don't know, probably about 6 inches square would have straps. And the reason this is important is sometimes the breastplate is described almost like a Roman or a Spanish breastplate. So there's these dual sort of descriptions. We have one where it's a smaller sort of ceremonial thing, and one where it's a full sort of military breastplate. And I the reason I find that interesting, because like I said at the beginning, it is entirely plausible that Joseph Smith could have dug up or otherwise traded for an old bronze or Spanish conquistador breastplate that would have come to them via Indian burial.
Yeah, we have several really curious ideas floating around in Joseph Smith's time that could have been a breastplate. So we have this idea that maybe he traded for it, he'd gotten a hold of a breastplate somehow. We have and maybe he actually recovered a breastplate from the Hill Cumorah. That's an option. But then we have this layman that magicians used for a breastplate around their neck that was used to control and summon spirits. And then we also have this idea from Royal Arch Masonry of the high priest wearing a breastplate while translating ancient scripture that had been recovered.
Well, one of the things I find compelling about this is it solves a conundrum that's been around for a while, which is if Joseph Smith retrieved the Urim and Thummim from Hill Cumorah, why did he use a seer stone to translate the Book of Mormon? if the Urim and Thummim was something he wore around his neck to summon spirits, to summon Moroni or Nephi or whoever, and then he was looking at the stone, so he was wearing it and then looking at the stone in his hat, that solves the dilemma of why he was using two different magical pieces. But in folk magic, in Wiccan stuff, it is really common to bring a cacophony of little symbols together.
Yeah.
And that's part of, like, doing spells and bringing out, you know, like if you bring the nail from a coffin and you bring the skull of a badger or something. So bringing these multiple elements together to achieve higher magic would have been something they would have pursued.
Yeah. And think about it. Joseph is always on a quest for more power, if you will. As a magician, he's using these laymans and daggers and seer stone and so forth, trying to get more power in order to obtain the scripture. And then and then after the church is organized in Nauvoo or in Kirtland, he restores the high priesthood, which he calls an endowment of power. He needs more power before he sends the missionaries out. And they build the Kirtland Temple, where they get an endowment of power, Pentecostal power. But this is before the endowment was conceived. And then in Nauvoo, this endowment or this infusion of power occurs in the temple when they go through this ceremony. So it's always about, how do I get this spiritual power? And it goes clear back to the magic days before the church was ever organized. He's trying to get this power.
For sure. And you see that layering all the time in the church. You know, you have the Aaronic priesthood, then you have the Melchizedek priesthood, yeah. and of course there's an evolution of these ideas, and you have the higher order, the Melchizedek priesthood. That I mean, it's in the Doctrine and Covenants where we say prophet, seer, and revelator, but he goes and says, you know, a seer is better than a prophet, you know, and then the prophet, priest, and king, he's bringing together, and he's claiming all these different offices, even in the Kirtland, Pentecost. You know, he's it's not just that he's the prophet that was appointed by Jesus. He has to have Moses come and give him power, and Enoch give him power, and Elias give him power, and Elijah. And he's like bringing all these things, the restoration of these things together, which is a foundational idea that comes in Masonry, where you're moving through these different levels. You're gaining more of these, yes, of these esoteric powers.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's very interesting and an excellent parallel.
So these laymans, where do you see them otherwise influencing the thought process or Mormonism?
Well, I've kind of covered primarily what I've looked at and seen. You know, you have all these. You really have a very rich set of magical ideas. The laymans that Joseph Smith had were not. You can't find the ideas for them in any single book. They were pulled from multiple books.
Right.
So this isn't just sitting down one day, pulling something out of the library and copying it down. This is somebody researching and looking into this. A very good candidate for this that helped them put these together is Lumen Walters, mm-hmm. who is a somebody that they had helping look for treasure. He was considered to have all this kind of super, really powerful magician guy, and he may have helped them put the laymans together. That's entirely possible. He traveled in Europe. They said he had a lot of books, and he definitely was a magician. So that's a possibility.
And some of these ideas actually still have legs. I mean, a lot of this early sort of seeking for treasure and seeking for new knowledge. I mean, we haven't had a revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants for a long time, and the more modern ones are administrative. But we still have the coal mine, the dream mine down in Utah
yeah.
County,
yeah.
where there's still that idea of treasure that cannot be achieved until the right time, that there's these elements of Nephite or Lamanite magical elements or gold that are buried. Among folk Mormon belief, especially in Utah, in rural Utah, these ideas are still there.
Yes, right. There's something compelling, I think, to humanity about this magical, supernatural, religious element that pulls people in. And it's always been there, and it always will be there. But we live in a much more secular age now than at the time of Joseph Smith. And as we talked about earlier, that all was normalized. Today, it's much less normalized, and it seems stranger, more far out there. But still, it's very compelling. We all love this idea of mystical magic, and we love to watch movies about that, whatever. And it draws in. There's something in humanity that is drawn to that.
Well, and I think, and the term is kind of loaded, but you look at conspiracy theories today; they follow the same sort of element. There's this esoteric knowledge that's hidden in plain sight. I mean, people who believe in the Illuminati, or that the moon landing was faked, or that the Clintons are running a super secret global like child pedophilia ring, you start looking and you see evidence here and you see evidence here and you see evidence here, and you can talk to the people who believe these things, UFO cover-ups or whatever they are. There's something about finding little pieces of data and clinging together this story that's hidden in plain sight that really appeals to our minds. And I'm not trying to cast shade on what Smith and those guys were doing. I'm trying to say we see this pattern emerge over and over and over again, and getting these little pieces and putting them together. I imagine those nights, you know, in Kirtland, where they come off the farms and they sit there in the School of Prophets, and they're just engaged. Here's a mummy showing up. Here's this Joseph Smith writing the Book of Moses that's been lost. Here's this new scripture that we're plumbing for hidden information. It just must have felt so alive and so vibrant.
Yeah. And see, Joseph Smith is, it's like he sees these building blocks for religion that he takes out of his environment, masonry and magic and Christian, the ideology of the Christianity in America at the time. And this is where he's a prophet. He builds a religion out of these building blocks. And he takes it to a new higher level. I think he did some wonderful things. I like the idea that hell is gone, that everybody gets a grand degree of glory. And Joseph Smith says, you yourself can be deified. You know, he lifts, a lot of people like to down talk, oh, Joseph Smith, he was a, you know, this and that. But he was a grand builder. And I think that's what a prophet is. And that's what humanity does. We want to answer these big questions. We need that answer. We crave those answers. And Joseph Smith is building, and he's trying to provide those answers the best way he can from the environment, from the building blocks that he has in front of him.
Yeah, I think the most unfortunate thing that happened was that Mormonism became too successful. They got to have too many people. And once that happened, then you had to start worrying about power and governance and structure, and it's the natural course of humanity that once we get power, then it starts to get corrupted and it starts to get abused. But those early days, like the Kirtland period, to me is so fascinating because these are people who are connected. They all know each other, and they're up there, and they're it's just the wonder of the world I can see reflected in their diaries and what they were writing.
Yeah, I can't imagine. It had to be so exciting to live at the time of Joseph Smith. I mean, what a roller coaster, crazy ride, that just had to be so danged exciting.
It had to be, and whatever sins we want to lay at the feet of Joseph Smith, I really there's some people who want to turn this treasure seeking and this folk magic and the masonry into like proof of his nefarious intent. But I like the way you're framing it out, which is what I agree with, that he was using what was at his disposal just like we do today. And he was playing with these things, and for whatever reason it stuck. You know, we have people all over the city, in every city, who are reading tarot cards and doing this, that, and the other. And normally it's just this fun little larky thing that people do. Well, if you took some tarot reading kid in Cincinnati and suddenly people started saying he was the prophet, maybe because he says he's the prophet, but a movement starts coming behind, it could get out of control really quick. And I think in part that's what happened when they built the Kirtland Temple. They were there, they had succeeded, and now what? And that's when Mormonism kind of took a left turn into some of the darker political and the things that come along with that, fighting and wars and murder and other bit of that. But I see there's this kind of humble purity in this early treasure seeking and masonry influence that just kind of sparks the imagination, almost like a game of Dungeons and Dragons, you know?
Yeah. And we like games like that. And it's kind of like these Jungian, if you're familiar with Carl Jung, he talks about these archetypes that all humanity is drawn to. And we're compelled towards these. It drives us, these archetypes. And Joseph Smith is building a bridge out into this collective unconsciousness that we all share that is accessible either from a secular viewpoint or a supernatural or a religious viewpoint. But Joseph Smith extremely successfully is bridging this gap out into that world that we all, that humanity seems to crave. And yeah, and I think so, right, we can look at all the problems of the church and Joseph Smith and so forth, but I think it's important that we realize what's really going on. And I think that there is the church is kind of fumbling right now, trying to figure out how to talk about religion to particularly the millennials, and the correlated view isn't working well. But I think there's material here that works or that can work, but we need to embrace it, not shy away from it. That's what I think.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting point there that I oftentimes remind myself. Some of the things I find repugnant about religion or ceremony, not just Mormonism, but otherwise, the people who actually engaged in those ceremonies didn't feel that way about them. Like, I'm putting a modern sentiment and a misunderstanding of what they're doing, because there's no way I can fully ever grasp what was going on in Kirtland and Nauvoo. I wasn't there. I wasn't part of that culture. I wasn't part of that scene. So I'm imposing all sorts of modern belief on it, which is, I think, is important, because as you described the church today, that's what they're doing. They're struggling with this stuff, and rather than letting it be what it was and say, well, this is what our ancestors did, it doesn't really speak to us, but here it is, and just sort of owning it and in a way saying, we're not responsible for this, you know, but they have a tendency or a failure to do that because they feel like they have to have this mantle of authority, not recognizing where Joseph Smith got it in the first place and what he was claiming.
Yeah, and you know, that's the nature of institutions. I mean,
absolutely.
It's just,
this is not uniquely Mormon.
It's just what institutions do. They end up with some, and you know, if you ever read Max Weber or look at his, new religions pop up and they are so captivating, and the charisma of the leader, and people are ignited. But then it gets handed off to the priestly people, and then they try to correlate it all, and then and that's the way things happen. It's just the way it happens, and it's not just Mormonism. That's the way it always goes of them.
And I think that's a really important point, because when you look at the character and nature of what makes one of the 12 apostles today in the Mormon church versus what made them in the first place, it was two entirely different sets of people. And these guys were seekers, and they were looking for a direct connection to the divine. And today in the church, we're looking for a connection to the divine through like obedience, through study, through this rote sort of thing. And you're exactly right. It's happened in every single religious tradition ever that's been successful.
And I don't envy the jobs of them at all.
No, they have the worst job in the world.
It's an extremely difficult job to try to balance the needs of the current people with the history of the past, and then tie that into this charisma of Joseph Smith. That's a tough job. It's just tough.
It absolutely is. Well, I think this was a great overview and introduction to kind of these things. Of course, this is a deep topic, and there's a lot of different people writing about it. So you gave a presentation at Sunstone. So you can go to the Sunstone archives. That right now, the way Sunstone works, the first 6 months, I think you pay a dollar or two to view them, and they become part of the open domain. So if you're listening to this years in the future, your talk's available. do you have anything else that you've written or you published about this?
Well, I gave three papers at Sunstone. One was on the connection between Mormonism, magic, and masonry. And there's I encourage you to listen in, because there's some stuff. It's a fascinating story of a forgery that ends up in masonry, and then ties into Joseph Smith and magic, and into Lucy Mack's Faculty of Abrac. It's a really cool story. That's in the archive, and is you can listen to it. I did one on the Beatles and rock music think people really enjoyed it. It actually has some music to it. But yeah, this is basically what I've covered on this. I've got a lot more. I hope to do more presentations in the future about this topic and yeah.
Well, I certainly hope you do. Claire, if there's folks who would like to engage you further on this, where can they reach you?
You know, on Facebook, if they just find Claire Barris or Claire Von Barris, there's not many of us out there.
B-A-R-R-U-S.
U-S. Yeah, C-L-A-I-R-B-A-R-R-U-S. Just pop me a messenger, and I'd be glad to talk to you.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating. This is a really interesting topic, and one that still enlivens with my imagination, those early days of Mormonism and what they were trying to do. Thanks for sharing it with us, and I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. It's great to be here.